Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm excellent, man. Had a good week. I hope you have as well. I understand you've been pretty busy.
Well, I've been busy, kind of moving out of the one job, starting to make some inroads into the new job. And speaking of super fantastic, I've got my farewell lunch tomorrow from some of my Sybase friends, kind enough to be having a lunch for me. And sometime in the past, they gave me a shirt on it that said "Super Fantastic." It's like a T-shirt, and that's all it says on the shirt is "Super Fantastic." So, I guess I say that quite a bit, and kind of my reputation for using that phrase. So I'm wearing that to the lunch. It'll be the first time I've ever
phrase.
Yeah, worn clothing with. Well, I think of "Live to See It" as my catchphrase, but I don't know. This seems to be the one that's captured the imagination, at least at Sybase.
I like that. I think the first time you said it on the show was probably about a month or so into the Blog Talk Radio show. You made that your kind of standard response to how things are going. So, super fantastic.
And it's easy once you get, not to say that it's just a habit or anything, but after a few hundred times somebody asks you how you're doing, you say "super fantastic." It's just like if you normally say "fine," right? I mean, that's just my answer, right? A doctor asks me, anybody asks me, I'm super fantastic. That's how I am. And
that's great.
It's a fun answer because half the people don't hear it, and half the people go, "Really? Well, that's kind of nice to hear." You know, like kind of respond to the kind of over the topness of it, I suppose.
Well, HB says live to be super fantastic. That's a
mashup. I like it.
Well, that's great. That's great. Well, we got a lot to talk about tonight.
We certainly do.
I've kind of been blogging up a storm more than normal here last few days, and you've thrown up a couple of thought provoking posts as well. I think the plan is we're just going to kind of cover those, get into discussion on those tonight.
Yeah. Well, our topic in the show description is we're going to talk about improbable futures, implausible futures, futures that the odds might seem to be stacked against, but that are worth taking a look at nonetheless. And it occurred to us that most of what we've been talking about have at least some aspect of implausibility to them. But I think the one that really gave the show its title, because I didn't want to call it Fast Forward Radio Cars for the Blind, that seemed too narrow of a topic for an entire show. But that was definitely the topic that kicked off that idea. You put that piece up earlier this week about Cars for the Blind, and I have to say that I saw that headline and I assumed it was a joke. You know, I mean, I totally did. It never occurred to me that there really would be drivable cars for the blind. So let's talk about this a little bit. The difference between a car for the blind and a completely robo-driven car is what exactly?
Okay. There are no actuators that move the pedals or the steering wheel. That may be an overstatement, okay? But it allows the driver to drive completely But it cues the driver into what's going on around him with, for someone who doesn't have sight. It has all the same technology that an automatic car would, in that the car knows what's going on around it. But rather than, completely taking control of the car, it's just cluing the driver in. You know, you need to turn this way, you need to turn that way, and you need to, brake or whatever. I think that it's a dead-end technology. I think it's it's an interesting path, and that it's not a waste of time. Please understand, I'm not saying that the people that are working on this system are wasting their time. I think it's a fantastic project, but I don't think that we will ever see this kind of system deployed on the roads. What it will end up being is it will end up teaching us about how to make better completely automated cars, and that will certainly benefit the blind and the rest of us who would rather be doing something besides driving on our way to work or whatever.
So, is the idea that the system provides them via touch? Is that the idea? Via touch, they're getting the input that they need to make decisions about what to do in the same way that we get input visually. It's kind of like Braille driving. Is that the concept?
Exactly. A vibrating steering wheel. You know, if you need to, turn to the right, it'll vibrate on the right. If you need to turn to the left, it'll vibrate on the left. I have some questions about that. What about when you're doing hand over hand in a tight turn? You know, I mean, what's it doing then? What level of communication can it get across to a driver as far as now you need to turn tighter, let off on the turn? I don't believe. Now this, if we have blind listeners, please understand, I'm not trying to be insulting at all. It may be just complete ignorance on my part, but I'm saying that I don't know if the amount of information that we get visually can be duplicated in that way. And so, I have some doubts about that. But let me just say that the test they showed on the closed track was pretty impressive. They had a blind driver, blind all his life. Behind the wheel. He drove at about 25 miles per hour on a closed track, and they were throwing out boxes on the road at random, and he was able to negotiate around the block, around these boxes and bring his car to a safe stop after a lap or two. So that's pretty impressive. Will it work in the real world? I would just guess not. But that's, again, maybe more my ignorance than anything else. But a project like this can teach us about making automated cars even better, maybe it'll lead to us having it sooner or better systems when we do get them. So,
well, I can tell you that from reading On Intelligence, we were talking about that book a few weeks ago. One of the things that's known about the brain, and you've heard this before anyway, of course, is that if you lose your eyesight, or if you've never had eyesight, your other senses are heightened. Now this is a truism, well known. But in fact,
right,
there is brain physiology studies that back this up. That in fact, a person who can't see has the visual portion of their brain, the brain that would normally be devoted to eyesight, suddenly devoted to all kinds of touch response mechanisms. So in fact, the actual brain processing is going on. So the question is not really whether you could by touch receive this, process the same amount of information you could, because it's the same. Ultimately, it's the same hardware running the equation, right? I guess the question is. And there's certainly no question that a blind person would be sensitive to. You could make it a very fine set of inputs that they were getting, much finer than distinctions you or I would ever be able to distinguish. That would be meaningful to them. That wouldn't be meaningful to us. That would allow them to interact. I think the real question is whether the sense of touch, with its dependency on things occurring in a linear way, could ever be as fast as the sense of sight, right? Because you can, it seems to me that you can look and you can take in a whole scene immediately, whereas the scene as relayed in driving instructions, and I think you're, you know, hand over hand turn, does it needs to be a little tighter, those kinds of things, those kinds of subtleties, they would have to be conveyed in a more or less linear fashion. And for that reason, it could never be quite as fast. It seems to me that the problem is the input device being the hands, which don't take in information as fast as the eyes. But I too am speaking from a point of not really knowing an awful lot about it. I think the reason it would never fly, though, ultimately, even if the system were perfected, and realizing that eventually we're going to have robots driving us straight up, right, without any human involvement, I believe that it could just never pass. You know what I mean? It could never be made legal.
That's
the bottom line.
Put it this way. You are listening, folks, to two of the more open-minded guys about this sort of thing, and we both have our doubts. So, you know, would it be able to pass down at your local city council or your local state house? I would guess probably not. Now, what I think the public will more readily accept a system made for everybody, an automated car that blind people could get in and have it take them places too. So I think that, you know, one thing, I had not even considered, you know, the impact that a completely automated car would have on blind people before. You know, talk about opening up your world. If you're a blind person living alone and you basically have to depend on, you know, somebody to come by and take you places, how great would that be? How liberating would that be to have your own car that could take you wherever you wanted safely? And so that's, you know, all good things. It's nothing really negative about that story at all. The other thing I said was, you know, the other reason I thought that this probably is a dead end pursuing this particular avenue is that it's my hope that the blind don't stay blind, at least in the way that we consider it a disability. The same technology that's been used in cochlear implants and has been perfected over about, what, the last 30 years, Phil, something like that. It's now begun to be experimented on with the visual cortex, using the same kind of surgery and allowing a visual processor, you know, mounted on glasses perhaps, to feed information to the visual cortex that way. My understanding is they've had success with people that have been recently blinded, but those who've been blinded from birth, not as much. Because again, the brain has rewired itself
it's already set itself up to take in touch information. But as someone has pointed out in the chat room, the brain can ultimately be rewired. So it might take a while, but after, for example, a person who has been sighted their entire life, who becomes blind over time, rewires their brain to use that section that was devoted to visual input. A lot of it becomes touch. So the same process could happen in reverse. But, you know, a lot of that malleability of the brain probably also depends on the age at which it occurs. It's probably just like trying to learn a language or ride a bike or a lot of other things. It's easier to impress upon the young, nimble system than it is older systems. What an unbelievably unexpected transition to the next topic, which is the importance of lifelong learning. Now, I thank you, Stephen, for you put our show notice up today, and that you called that item the importance of lifelong learning rather than the extremely unlikely future of Phil learning calculus, which is really what
it was ostensibly about. Yeah.
Talk about improbable. Here's this one.
Well, I think, you know, Phil, it's just a matter of whether you make it a priority or not. I have every faith that if you chose to spend some time learning calculus, you'd you could probably pick it up fairly easily. It's just one of those things that a lot of us have had mental blocks about because, you know, I don't know. At some point in my local school district, they just dropped teaching it at all at the high school level. In the particular parish, that I grew up in, we say parish here in Louisiana rather than county. In the parish I grew up in, I think probably in the early 1970s, they stopped teaching it altogether. Too difficult, or it's just not needed for our students here. We're the farthest you can go in math is algebra 2, and so that was pretty much a set thing. Maybe a couple of the magnet schools now you might be able to pick it up, but basically it's become a thing that's reserved for college now, and so you managed to get through college as well without calculus. So.
I clept out of math, and so I never took any. And I'd gotten as far as pre-calc in high school, which was one class beyond algebra 2, algebra and trig, but it wasn't quite calculus. It was like all the stuff you need to do leading up to calculus, but not quite calculus. So I kind of missed my window on learning it, not for free, but as part of a course of education that I was already getting. But hey, we're going to come back to this. I just want to make a note. I read it in the chat room earlier, and I meant to mention it between topics, and then we had that unbelievable segue between the two. So I got caught up. But I want to note that Matt has reported in the chat room that as of today he is employed by the University of Pittsburgh Microbiology Department. So our congratulations to Matt. We've been following your attempts to land a job, and we're very happy for you.
Oh, that's awesome. Congratulations, Matt. That's great. That's great. Wanted to read this comment to your post on, the possibility of learning calculus. As you know, he basically explained this particular commenter, Peter Fritz, says, speaking as someone who has a Bachelor of Mathematics, I can say that having some understanding of calculus gives you the insight into how Euclid to Einstein were actually able to derive the basic laws of geometry and physics. With calculus, you can understand why the area of a circle is pi r squared and why the inverse cube root works for all radiation-type effects. So my basic recommendation is not necessarily remembering all the various formula, but understanding why there are formula. Just my 2 cents. So, hey, that sounds right.
I mean, that's what I'd like to know. I'd like to have that level of understanding. And I always feel that when I'm somewhat intimidated by mathematical info, I always think, I wonder if I had ever taken calculus, if that would help me with this. I'll see some, it starts getting into figures and I'm not quite sure. And sometimes it's not. I mean, sometimes it's statistics or something, and I don't know that calculus would have helped at all. But one of my obviously great interests is reading about science, reading about technology. And, based on that input, it seems like that it would be a very reasonable thing to do. Question in the chat room, does Khan Academy have calc? They do indeed. I mentioned in my post one of the reasons that I say there's just no excuse for anyone who wants to learn calculus or whatever, physics, whatever topic they may have had some interest in or may have been intimidated by in the past and have decided to give it another shot. The materials are there. They're there and they're free. I mean, I could take an MIT course on calculus if I wanted to, absolutely free, because those are available via the internet now.
Yeah, and he has other things as well. He started just with math only, but he's built up so many courses on all these various things that he's started doing general science, and then he even has gotten a little bit into history and a few other things. So you can get quite an education at that free website. That is just awesome what he has set up there, and he's had some pretty famous people talk about how great it is. He had Bill Gates mentioned that he's encouraging his kids to use Khan Academy, and I know I'm using another famous person myself.
Well, there you go, Stephen Gordon.
Yeah, Stephen Gordon.
There it is.
Yeah, that's right. We're going to go straight to the top of famous people. I'm having my kids use it as well, and I tell you, it's just fantastic because, you know, he's very, very crystal clear. He's not he is doing this from a basis of complete understanding himself, so that he's not reading out of some dull textbook. He's just telling you what he knows, and he has an ability to get it across easily. And, you know, if you don't get it the first time, hey, back it up and watch it again. You know, I mean, it's you know, you have an infinitely patient teacher there. So,
a teacher at your disposal whenever you want to take the class. Start when you want, stop when you want, repeat things when you want. It is everything that we were promised one day computer education would be. It's like that implausible future. That implausible future where we would have computer technology that would be the ultimate teacher has, in a sense, arrived. It's arrived via things like Khan Academy, and Khan Academy being just a terrific example of it. And it's just another good example of when you look at it and you go, oh, I guess that does meet all the criteria. Once again, you're not as impressed as you thought you were going to be just because you go, well, it's a guy doing a bunch of YouTube. I mean, he's doing them very well, and he's done quite a few of them, but it doesn't seem like this overwhelming thing. Until you step back and say, when was this ever available in the world before? When did you ever have this opportunity to have access to that kind of information, to have a teacher like that? And the answer is never before. This is the first time in history that we've really had this capability. And I think it's a good idea for us to capitalize on that. I think it's a good idea for us to capitalize on it so that we can be conversant in science and technology, which are important topics. It's important for people living in a society that is so driven by science and technology, especially technology, to understand these basic concepts, to understand what it is, you know, to the extent that it's possible, to understand what it is that is driving us along. So, I think it's important from a societal standpoint that people take advantage of these kinds of resources and continue to educate themselves throughout their lives. I also think it's probably important as a personal strategy. One of the things that can keep a brain more limber, I was just talking about how, you know, the mind, as the body, starts to stiffen as you get older, starts to slow down a bit, and, you know, doesn't have that same pep that it used to, but one of the ways you can keep it as limber as possible is to take on completely new subject matter and to take on new challenges, to make your brain do things it hasn't done it for a long time or that it has never done before. I think that is a key to keeping your brain sharp and, in a sense, to keeping yourself young.
Absolutely. I've often, you know, you think of people like Supreme Court justices. Those guys live to be 95, you know, and they are constantly having to consider new and interesting problems, and they never retire, you know.
It's true. That's an excellent point. They hang in for a long time, and that entire time, they are grappling with complex issues. They're trying to apply, you know, highly complex models to new and unexpected sets of circumstances, right? That's a great example. We want to put our brains on the Supreme Court diet here, and see if we don't.
those guys aren't hitting the gym, you know. I mean, that's not what's keeping them young. It's
that we know.
I've yet to see a Supreme Court justice, you know, pumping iron. You know, I would love to see that. I think that'd be great, but. I think that primarily it's the fact that that retirement is not really considered an option. It's sort of funny, you know, when a president appoints you to be Supreme Court justice for whatever party he is from, it's almost as if you're expected to do it until you die because, you know, I've appointed you. You're to be my legacy for the next, you know, 40 years or whatever, you know. And so it's part of what you take on when you take that job, I think, is I have to live a long time and I have to, you know, reflect the values of whatever, you know, side of the fence I was nominated.
Yeah, they're on a mission.
It's sort of your mission.
Another life extension tip from the Supreme Court, now that we've veered into this unexpected topic, is be on a mission. Be on a mission. Keep your brain sharp. Keep thinking about that.
Yeah, new stuff all the time. So
if you do wear the robe. That's all I'm asking. I'd like to see, you know, like Kennedy, right, on the bench press, right, in the robe, right, you know, asking, I don't know, Sotomayor to stop him or something.
And Sotomayor yelling, and they're yelling behind him, it's all you.
Yeah, and she's over on the stair, man. That's fine. But still, in the robe. That's
exactly.
Okay, we're getting silly here, but I to leave that topic, I would just say I think that whatever the probability of Phil learning calculus is, it was at one time considered a highly implausible, highly improbable future that information would be freely available like this, and that a good, I mean, a credible substitute for formal education would be available essentially to everybody, essentially for free. That was at one time a highly improbable future, and that is the very future we're living in now.
Absolutely. I mean, think of our parents' generation. I mean, pretty much if you didn't catch it, you know, sometime between K through 12, or if you're lucky, you know, went to college. If you whatever it was that you didn't pick up during that time or pick up on the job after you started working, you know, you pretty much had what you had. You know, by the time you were 30, and, you know, that's what you're going to live with the rest of your life, you know, to some
right.
extent. I exaggerate a little, but, you know, if, you know, you get busy with work and with raising kids and things like that, you know, your opportunities for learning a whole new thing like calculus were probably a little bit limited. And, but, you know, as, you know,
there has been this pattern, some folks in retirement would actually go back to school. They would audit classes,
yeah.
or sometimes really ambitious folks would even pursue a degree, you know, in their 70s or 80s, and that was always an option. But and I think it's a great option, and I encourage people to do that. But I would also say don't wait till then. Keep
right.
learning now. There's no time to be lost in trying to keep up with everything there is for us to know. Okay, so
put it this way: if you're 60 and you haven't learned anything new since you were 30, you're not likely to go back to school. You need to be a lifelong. You need to be lifelong about this sort of thing.
That's for sure. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the social singularity. This is a fascinating topic. This is probably one that we will do an entire show on somewhere down the road, if not a series of shows. To what extent are we going through? Maybe not talking about the specific idea that we're going to get into here in a moment, but when I see those words social singularity, I think, wow, that's happening now, isn't it? Are we in a social singularity today?
Well, I think we are within the gravity well of a social singularity. You know, I mean,
okay.
we have Facebook now. We have, you know, other lesser popular social networks, but, you know, Facebook's the big one. And,
right.
And, you know, to me, I find Facebook fascinating. I click onto it in the morning with my coffee, and it's like the newspaper of people I actually care about, you know?
Right.
It's, I hear about, somebody's kids taking karate and they're proud of him, and, you know, we went camping last weekend and it rained all weekend. That's that kind of stuff, you know, to me. It's a lot more interesting than the local news at 10 o'clock, you know. And it's not limited by space, so I could hear, you know, I not only hear about my next door neighbor and what, you know, what's going on with them, but you know, I would also hear about you, Phil, or PJ, or other people that are, you know, states away, but who I consider friends and who, you know, I'd like to know what's going on in their lives. So. It's just really cool, and you know, because we're all you know, many of us are carrying smartphones around all the time. We are updating it on a fairly regular basis. You know, anything halfway interesting happens in the course of our day. You know, we often will get on there and just do a little blurb on it, and then the people that we care about will read about us. So it's kind of a neat thing. So. Yeah, Facebook is awesome, and the reason for its success is that we all get to hear about people we actually want to hear about, and And so, you know, there's that.
There is that, and that is kind of a fundamental transformation of how we learn about, how we keep in touch with people in our lives, and a fundamental transformation of who gets to be in our life, right? Which used to be kind of geographically limited. And, you know, it's interesting when you talk about those tidbits, who went camping, it rained all weekend, whose kids in karate. You can now get what would have once been a month's worth of that kind of stuff in one morning, right, at one sitting, because you're not going to run into all those people every day, and you're not going to catch up with them every day. So normally it would take a long time to get that much status on those on all those people. So it's like people complain about how technology has created this superficial kind of connection between people, but the truth is we can be a lot more connected to people than we were able to be in the past, simply because it breaks down the barrier of distance, it breaks down the barrier of time, and we're able to interact with people. And you and I have talked about this a lot, who are far away, but also, you know, somebody who's two blocks away, but that you just don't get to see that often. But on Facebook, there they are. You know what's happening with them. You can even leave a comment. You share a quip. Suddenly you're having a conversation with them. So, yeah, I agree. I think we're in the gravity well, if not starting to circle that black hole of the social singularity. So much of what you and I do, Stephen, has been social media driven throughout. I mean, I would certainly count blogs and a podcast as social media. And I'm looking here, you know, we've written blog posts. Here we are talking about them on the podcast. We've got the chat room going, and I see that Matt is now offering to be my calculus tutor, and I'm going to take you up on that, Matt. If I do Khan Academy classes in calculus over there on YouTube. So, you know, just the number of different ways these various social media threads are kind of interacting together and giving us new ways to interact and connect with each other. It's pretty astounding. But that's not even what you're talking about. You're talking about something else altogether when you use the term social singularity.
Okay, well, this is kind of a fascinating idea, and it comes from a novel I just started. When you come across a book that's kind of interesting, that has some interesting concepts, you know how you take it slow? I find that I fly through books that are marginally interesting to me, and I sip at books, you know, for a month. That I find really, really fascinating. This particular book, it's a novel entitled EvoCloud, and it's built around this concept called the social singularity. And basically, you earn what's called karma merits, for helping others within the network. So, you know, if someone posts on there, you know, that, hey, I've just had a flat tire, I'm on Highway 71. If you show up and help them change the tire, you're going to earn some car merits. And then the more car merits you have, you know, the higher priority you have to getting your need met when you have a need. So, you know, you kind of are pushed to the top of, you know, a list of potential, you know, projects for people that are other people who are trying to earn car merit. And, I thought it was pretty fascinating. They have a mission statement within the book. This is obviously a fictional mission statement of this EvoCloud company, okay? And the mission statement is love must evolve. It sounds a little like Google's don't be evil, you know?
Right, love must, the next step, yeah.
Exactly. Love must evolve. The love that we know brings fulfillment through sharing, but it is never free of the hurtfulness of rivalry. We must facilitate a more just form of love. So basically they're saying, I think what's being said there is love is great, but being humans, we can never really get rid of, you know, rivalry or wanting to, you know, what is in it for me, that feeling. So acknowledging that we are human and that we are limited by that, why don't we build a system that allows us to act as though we are complete angels, while fulfilling that human what's in it for me business, okay? And so I think it's just a fascinating idea. What if you know, basically, you know, somebody running for office one of the first questions you might ask them in this particular future is, well, how many car merits do you have? I mean, how much have you helped people? You only have that many? We're not interested in you.
You don't have enough karma. You've not built up enough karma to rate the job.
Exactly. And so, get out there and, go in Habitat for Humanity for 6 months and come back and try us again. I think it's a fantastic idea. I compare it in the comment I made afterwards. I was commenting to something you said, Phil. I compared it a little bit to money. In a way, back in the Stone Age before the invention of money, pretty much I would share, as a caveman, would share with someone who was within my tribe who had perhaps been generous to me or who had an opportunity to be generous to me later. But I would never dream of being generous to a stranger, okay, and do something for a stranger. We do things for strangers all the time, Phil. I mean, and today, and why is that? Well, we have money. I do something for a stranger, I'm paid. I then can use that money to get another stranger to do something for me. We all work for each other. Everyone is everyone else's servant thanks to the invention of money. Well, how would this be any different? Well, I think primarily a system like this would be different because it would better communicate need. Then I wanted to add in the local newspaper. Okay, help wanted. So, and it also would help communicate to others, how busy a person has been helping others because the amount of karma points they have. So, I think it's a pretty neat idea.
Let me ask a question about the setup of the book. Is there a money economy too, or everything just works on this car merits?
There is a money economy. This works side by side with the money economy, but people are like taking their free days and devoting it to projects to help others. People are using their Saturdays that you get off work and you check the Ebo Cloud. A shut-in needs groceries. I swing by, I grab some groceries, take it to the shut-in. I just picked up some karma points,
If the money economy and the car merits are separate. I take it there's no connection between them. You're not going to get money for having more car merits, or you can't go buy car merits for money, right? They exist completely independently of each other, right?
I would imagine in the real world there would be some crossover. What if I took some money and gave it to somebody that needed money? Would I not earn car merit points, or would I? If I gave to a charity, wouldn't that earn me some car merit points?
Fair enough.
On the other hand, if I'm in need of money, and I'm down and out or something, couldn't I basically cash in some karma points? That I've built up. I don't know. It seems to me in the real world there would be some crossover. And the real difference.
I can see that level of crossover, but it's not one of one. I can see how money could be used as the vehicle by which you do acts of merit that then get you car merits. But you're not ever going to. In other words, it's not like those carbon credits, right? You can't just go
exactly
right.
And
instead of engaging in the virtuous behavior, pay enough money and then you get the credit, right?
Exactly, and I suggest that it's tied to a person's ability. A poor college kid that's working his way through and has no money at all, he would earn car merit points by, getting out there and working on a project on the weekend. Maybe Habitat for Humanity. I mentioned that earlier. Whereas a rich older widow would, perhaps give some money to some, foundation or something and get karma points that way. So if it's
different for money, and say you're a really good person, Stephen, you've gotten tons of car merits, and I'm a so-so person. I've gotten a few. Michael Darling, he doesn't do fast forward radio anymore, so obviously his karma is way down, and he's got almost none, right?
So,
what's the difference between us? What can you do? What do you get? What's in it for you How is your life enriched over, say, mine or Michael's in that situation?
Okay. Let's say that me, you, and Michael then, take a road trip, and we round the curve, and we, you know, the car flips over, and we all have an identical injuries. Okay, we've all broken our leg. Okay,
and we're
all sitting up at the house. We're in traction or whatever, and so I've got a bunch of karma points. You've got a medium amount of karma points, and he's got practically none. And so we kind of let it be known out on the Ebo cloud that we're all in a bad way, and we need somebody to come walk our dog. We need somebody to bring by some groceries or something to the house or whatever. Since I've got a lot of karma points, perhaps my request for that kind of thing would reach a broader audience, or would be closer to the top of list of the list of people that need to be helped. You might be a few rows down on the list. It's sort of like having the most favored ad on the Google search page.
I see. Okay.
And so you might be a little further down the list, and Michael Darling is he's on the list because he's got a karma point or two, but he's so far down to the bottom that he's likely to get ignored. So that's
one of the features of this is that the less like you a person is, the more karma you get for helping that person. But before we go there, let's just stick with this. With this analogy, because this is really interesting. So let's say in that scenario you just painted, where the three of us have had an injury and we all need help, you're most likely to get the help just because you're better connected in the karma world. You're known and you're at the top of the list. However, let's say someone has stumbled upon the three of us and is in a position to help only one. Now, would it actually be worth more karma points to help me or Michael because we're bad people than it would be to help you because you're a good person, or would that make a difference?
Well, I would think that it would. And obviously, there are a thousand ways to build a system like this.
Right.
But
I'm within the system in the book as described, I guess.
Okay. Well, the system hasn't been fully described to me because I haven't read the entire book, but.
Okay.
I'm giving you my vision for how I would build the system. Okay, I would say that it would not be worth more to, some potential philanthropist to help me than you, just because I have more karma points. I would be more likely to be helped because I'm reaching a wider audience. I'm up at the top of the list, whatever. But I would not be worth more points to help. Now, let's say that it's a person of a different race that's helping me, then they might get more karma points for doing that because they're being the good Samaritan, helping the person that's not like them. Okay. They're reaching across ethnic barriers to help a person in need. I suggested perhaps we also award more karma points for reaching across and helping somebody that's not of our religion. Separates us one person from another, if we actually make it worth more in the karma system to somebody to reach across those barriers, then perhaps that could be a huge a vehicle for doing great things and building bridges. It's kind of a do-gooder kind of thing. It's an idea, and it's a little bit utopian, but I think it might actually even work if someone were to put it into effect. Build it in as an option on Facebook to try. Something like that. So.
Okay, that's interesting. So you're suggesting that not only is this a potentially workable idea, but that we might have the infrastructure for trying it out now owing to the social networks that we currently have. Very interesting.
Just build it in as an app on Facebook.
Yeah. I'd like to see someone do that. It seems like it can only be a matter of time before we see something like this.
I think it's inevitable. It's a powerful idea. Somebody's going to try it. Somebody probably two or three generations into it before it's really a great workable system. There's going to be some people stumble and build systems that are, for one reason or another, are not really workable, and they're just kind of scrapped. And but about three or four generations into it, there's going to be, you know, it's going to work. I feel like it's going to, it's, and it's going to be an important, you know, thing that allows us to view the other as less other, you know, allow us to do for people that we normally wouldn't think to do for. So, and I think that can only be a good thing.
Absolutely. Well, I love the idea of the greater the distance between two people, and it's going to be purely subjective, I think, how those criteria are set up. But
right,
there are so many ways, it seems, for people to be divided these days. And technology has actually, we talk about all the benefits of technology, we talk about all the great things that it's provided, but it's also given us good ways to really separate ourselves from each other. And, you know, we've talked about the echo chambers of the political chat rooms and blogs and online communities. And I think that to a lesser extent, you probably see a certain amount of that around ethnicities, around sex, around around religion. But it's really become pronounced, I guess, because it's the world of ideas, and an information environment is so perfect for housing the world of ideas that it seems that the political world has become much more strident, much more us versus them than it was in the past. So I like the idea of the technology that has allowed that division to become more pronounced a few generations down the road suddenly provides a set of motivations for starting to tear that down a little bit. Because if you're a big Keith Olbermann fan, then it's worth a lot more to you to help a Rush Limbaugh fan than it is to help one of your fellow Keith Olbermann supporters, right? That kind
exactly.
of idea.
Exactly. You know, I thought it was really, really great. There's a TED Talk, and I'm sorry I don't remember the name of this lady who gave it, but just a great TED Talk. She is, like I would imagine most of the people at TED, she actually asked people, you know, if you feel like you're left of center politically, would you raise your hand? Everybody in the auditorium raised their hand. And if you feel like you're right of center, would you raise your hand? And then, you know, like a guy that, you know, accidentally walked into the wrong auditorium, raised his hand, and then he left the building.
Right.
And she says, well, you know, as a person that's left of center, I found that I just couldn't even understand somebody that would go to a tea party. And so basically I called up the local Tea Party supporter, invited her to lunch. We sat down and talked, and we had a great time talking. You know, it turns out that she doesn't drink children's blood, you know?
Right.
It turns out we have a lot more in common than I ever thought possible. And so I would encourage everybody in here to, you know, take a conservative to lunch today. You need to set that up and do it. You'll find that, that people are, you know, when people believe a certain thing politically, it's usually based on a set of life experiences that they've had, and it's usually not irrationality or, you know, or evilness on their part that led them to those beliefs. So, you know, I think that the opportunity for getting together and understanding each other is a good thing. And so, you know, regardless of your politics or whatever, I think it's just a good thing. So I look forward to that.
That's a very encouraging story from TED Talks. I know PJ would appreciate a story like that about people learning to overcome this sense of others being the other and find empathy amongst for those that, with whom they have differences or with whom they disagree.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I will get a link to that in the chat in the show notes too.
Okay, absolutely. Yeah. Very good. Well, we're running close on time, and we've got one more topic. So I hope we gave that one a fair shake for a first time. Like I said, I think we'll probably do an entire show on this a little bit later in the year. Our next topic is alternate paths to greater than human intelligence. And this one kind of keys off a post I put up based on a Super Bowl ad that I saw. I had not heard of the movie Limitless until Sunday when I saw a couple of short trailers for it. They were one of the highly touted commercials for the Super Bowl, and later went on to YouTube and found a longer version of the trailer. And I'm very interested in this movie. Here you've got a story of a man who takes a pill, and that's going to turbocharge his brain. It makes him into a super genius. It makes him into essentially a greater than human intelligence, as I talked about in the blog post. There's a scene between the actor Bradley Cooper, who's the genius, and Robert De Niro, who I don't know what he plays, but he's some kind of foil to our hero, the genius. And De Niro says to him, "There's no scenario where you don't end up working for me." And Cooper says, "That's what you don't get. I see every scenario, and I'll always be 50 steps ahead of you." And, you know, is that hyperbole, or is that, you know, is that really how far advanced this medication he's taken has put him in terms of his mental capability? Well, assuming that he's just saying what's actually true, then we'd be talking about a drug that could produce greater than human intelligence. You're talking about a person who's maybe even smarter than the smartest of all smart people. So that opens up a couple of different, very intriguing transhumanist themes for us. These are both ideas that resonate with us at The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, both ideas we've talked about extensively, both on the blog and on this podcast. One being the idea of human cognitive enhancement, just the simple idea of taking steps to make your brain work better. And earlier we were talking about lifelong learning as perhaps not an act of enhancement, at least an act of damage control, at least an act of mitigating the loss of capability. But ultimately we're going to be looking for ways to make our brains work better. One is through technology. Stephen, we've talked about how Google serves as kind of an external set of cognitive abilities for us, Google and all of the internet, really. Another possibility is surgery. Another possibility is implants. And then a very intriguing possibility is that there might be a pharmacological solution. There might simply be a drug you can take that boosts your brain. Now, I think it's very unrealistic that anyone could take a pill and have the capabilities displayed in this trailer. To me, that's a highly improbable future. I'm not going to rule it out altogether, depending on what's in that drug. Although I would think that for a pill to do that, it would have to be more like a nanotechnology program that's putting little robots into your brain and actually restructuring your entire brain to bring about those kinds of changes. But it leads to the question, and my original question was, would you take the pill? If this pill existed, and assuming that there are no known horrible side effects, would you take it? And I'm on the record as saying I would absolutely take it. If I had one in front of me right now, I would swallow it before I finished this sentence. Okay, that's how eager I would be to have my thinking enhanced that way. I can't imagine anything more wonderful than being able to retain knowledge better, being able to understand what I'm seeing better, to be able to look at problems and intuit the solutions immediately. To me, that is the ultimate goal in life. I would love to do that. And I think, Stephen, you and I are pretty much on the same page on that.
Absolutely. I said I would do it as well. But then I offered a possible side effect that's not a physical side effect. I offered this. You know, what if we could take a pill like this? What would it mean to us socially? You know, speaking of the social singularity, it's two singularities clashing. You know, we got the greater than human intelligence clashing with the social singularity. You know, what would the company of normal people mean to somebody that's, you know, 10 times smarter than the next smartest person? Would people just bore you then? I suspect that they would. I just think that it would be a challenge to continue to be socially engaged with people if you were to become that intelligent. So
I saw those discussions, and one guy was saying my wife would have to have one because I'd be completely alone in the world without her, and I have to wonder about that. I can understand the thought process that says you'd be alone and you'd be isolated if you were that much smarter than everyone else. But the truth is there are a lot of different kinds of social interactions, and not all of them are particularly intellectual. So, you know, I'm saying that thinking of myself as about an average, you know, like everyone else, I estimate myself as being slightly above average in intelligence. So maybe the difference I'm seeing sometimes in some interactions isn't that great, and that this would propel me so far that that I really would just be bored to tears with other people. But, you know, I'm not 100% sure about that. It seems that there are smart people who get along fine with the rest of us anyway. One person, one commenter, humorously signed himself as Sheldon Cooper, and you think about that character from The Big Bang Theory, and he is insufferable, right? Absolutely insufferable in his disdain for the intellectual capabilities of everyone else around him.
including his roommate, who is a very smart person, but you know, is a mere shadow of his intelligence in his opinion. So
exactly,
yeah.
I think if what accompanied the boost in intelligence was going back to our earlier topic, a boost in empathy. If we were hyper intelligent, but also saw this as an ability to understand those around us better, maybe not to evaluate, put ourselves in a superior position to them, even though. And we all interact with people that we're a lot better at than some things, but we can still be friends with them because there are other interactions we can have with them. I think that that a highly intelligent person might find even more ways to interact with people, might find even more ways to be empathetic and to interact with people, even people who are significantly less intelligent than that person. So I'm not convinced that's a showstopper, and I wouldn't let it stop me. I'll put it that way. I would take the pill, even risking that I'd be the lone genius.
Sally mentions one person in history that's not often cited as an example of a genius, but Teddy Roosevelt could read two or three books during an evening's reading, never forgot what he read.
And he wrote dozens or hundreds of books, I think. He was writing books while he was president. Imagine that.
Yeah, in his spare time, yeah. You know, wouldn't it be great to be like that, you know?
Yeah.
I think it would be.
One of the lines in the movie is, I wrote my book in 4 days. He starts out taking the pill. He's got writer's block. He's a writer. He can't get going on this book project. Takes the pill and then writes the entire book in 4 days. And I think Sally was mentioning a movie from a few years ago. I can't remember the name of it. She said Keanu Reeves. I think it was actually John Travolta. The movie where he suddenly gains these immense mental powers. You remember that?
Yeah.
The movie I'm talking about? What was that called?
You think of Phenomenon.
Phenomenon.
Yeah.
Okay.
That was an interesting. I like that. That was a good story.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun because you see him suddenly doing all these things. You know, he's putting solar panels up, and he's replanted his garden. He's growing these huge tomatoes, and just everything is interesting. He learns Portuguese on a 25-minute car ride, all those kinds of things. You know, I watch that movie, and I'm just like, yes, that's where I want my life to go. Let greater than human intelligence begin with me. If given the opportunity, I will I'll take it there. Well, I see now we're running dangerously low on time. So we'll come back to this topic as well. Let's talk about our music.
Okay, from Super Genius to our song, Cave Girls is our song by the Rubinos. I hope everybody enjoys this. It's meant in good humor.
It's also fun. All right, well, thanks for putting that together, Stephen. Thanks to the chat room. Great online chat happening this evening. Thanks to everyone who listened live or who listens via recording. We'll be back on with the World Transformed 1.5, a planning session that I'll be doing next Saturday, an archive show next week, and back on with a live show again next Wednesday night. Hope you can join us for all those programs. And until next time, live to see it.
Mastodon roam, turn on the way back machine. Time to make the Pleistocene.
Cave girls want hot.
Think you wanna get down to bedrock?
Cave girls want hot.
Every little lady was a stone fox.
Stone, 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 stone.
Reclining on the bearskin rug, rolling around. slime and mud, the nail and scratch and claw. Tell you what made the eyes hit thaw.
Cave girls were hot.
Do you want to turn back the clock?
Cave girls were hot.
Every little lady was a stone fox. When 1,000 years BC is right where I want to be, I'm on a quest for 5 cave girls gone wild. I'm Tommy, 100% Cro-Magnon. My dream woman, well, she would walk upright and have an opposable thumb.
Some call me Java Man, but you can call me Al. I dig a woman who wears a bone through her hair and crawls around on all fours.
My name is John, and I'm the Neanderthal of the group. I like a woman who has my slippers and favorite drink waiting when I return from the hunt. I guess I'm a little old-fashioned.
Cave girls were hot.
Think you want to get down to bedrock?
Cave girls were hot.
Every little lady was a stone pot.
Dong, 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 dong.
Cave girls were hot. Up to see my cave.